But in listening to Jerry and Sam and Chris, it really reminded me of the significance and perhaps in these days the necessity of retreat, right? You know, retreat going back to the time of the Buddha has always been part of the meditative tradition, right? The capacity to, I mean, it's kind of funny because even you think about it in the Buddha's time, they led very simple lives removed from village life and community life as monastic community, and yet every year during the rainy season, they would retreat. They would stop moving about, and they would just stay, and they would just devote themselves to spiritual cultivation. So, you know, so again, in the meditative tradition, retreat has always been very important because it gives an opportunity to really focus very single-mindedly and deliberately on one's meditative practice and on really on awakening. But I think these days, and I think all three of you kind of expressed it, it's so much more beyond that. Because, and I've talked about this before, I won't get on my soapbox, but, well, just a little bit maybe. You know, we live in a culture that is so intrusive, right, through media that is so intrusive and so all-pervasive in our lives, as well as the speed of our life, the speed of our work, you know, is so revved up. And the speed with which, even when we're not in work, we move about our world and the way we hurry and rush and always on to the next, right? It is a kind of energy that pervades our whole society, and once we get into it, as many of us are into it, it is very hard not to just be taken along by it. So as people said, so even, you know, our meditative life is somehow done speedily and is kind of fit into this life of endless busyness and endless high speed revved up and endless stimulation, distraction. We try to find 20 minutes, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes to kind of stop things. And that's very difficult, as most of you had noticed. I mean, for most people, lay people these days, you know, just daily meditation is sort of just a chance to take a breath, you know what I mean? Take a couple of deep breaths and just kind of slow it down a little bit in the midst of our daily life. So, therefore, just hearing these young people, the retreat was how many days? 4 days. I mean, and yet, in those 4 days, because the environment was so out of your usual environment, you could understand things much more clearly. It's not, you probably, there's nothing there, like you said, in terms of teachings and practices that you haven't been exposed to here, but you had the 4 days and the nurturing environment, right, to really get it. Not just get it intellectually, but get it by living it. And that, I think, is really essential. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, traditionally concentration is called concentration or single-minded concentration, or it's called mental quiescent meditation. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it stopping. It's really, I mean, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh makes things very simple. He says, you know, we have to stop. If we do not stop, insight is impossible, right? So ideally, our daily meditation and our turning inward is enough time that we actually can stop, right? Coming to Sangha on Sunday or other times during the week for a couple of hours is hopefully a stopping, right? But again, as I say, it is very difficult for us because the energy that just our mind is functioning, it's really about the mind. I mean, the body is moving quick, and we're moving very quickly through activities, and always moving on to the next. And there's lots of pressure on people to perform and, you know, get things done in time, and, you know, schedules and deadlines, and all that kind of things. But the real issue is our minds are revved up. There is a continuous pressure in our mind that is made up of thought and emotion and just kind of an energetic movement that's very hard to break out of for many people. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a very personal kind of thing, but you can kind of feel it inside you. There's like a train going on in there, and it just keeps running, right? And sometimes you can kind of slow it down, and sometimes you can step out of it, you know, kind of take a break at the station for a little bit. The train stops, but then we get right back on. So that continuous movement of thought and emotion, there needs to be a way that we can break out of that, right? To experience ourselves, our mind, life in a radically different way so we can return to our roots. Is that clear? And so I guess what I'm saying is that what used to be kind of an extra value to the meditative life retreat, I think is these days, in an almost kind of purely mental health kind of way, emotional health kind of way, is a necessity. Because without it, this endless train of speeded up experience that is almost addictive. Do you know what I'm saying? People, you know, and I've commented on this before. It's, you know, how I just noticed that these days, people can't stop, right? They get up in the morning and right away they connect through their instrument or whatever that thing is called, right? They're right away connected, right? Getting information, right? And it's just continuous, right? And so the people today, even when they are doing things that in the past would be nourishing, like taking a break, people are still connected, right? Nothing's happening, make something happen. Do you know what I'm talking about? And it has an addictive quality in the sense that it's unconscious. You know, it's like, it just, and all of a sudden after a while, it just becomes this endless train of stimulation and experience that has this unstoppable quality to it. Do you know what I'm saying? And we're just kind of carried along by it. And we can't even differentiate our own emotional life, our own state of being, from all this stimulation, right? And this connection to the stories of everybody else in the world that's just unending. So, you know, listening to the three of them speak, it reminded me when I first encountered Thich Nhat Hanh back in the 70s, and stayed with them, it was very interesting to me. And they were living, even though he was a monk, he was living in Paris and really just living more of a life of a layperson, just in terms of their work and energy. That once a week, whether they call it a day of mindfulness or a lazy day, it was a very interesting day because it wasn't a formal day of mindfulness the way we do it here with a schedule and all that. But it was, and again, they were very, I mean, in the 70s there, they were in the midst of, you know, the war was going on. They were very active in supporting a lot of the refugee work and a lot of the disaster that was going on within their community and Vietnam fundraising. They were very active in trying to stop the war. So, I mean, they were doing just very significant, emotionally wrenching work. And yet, and I forget what day of the week it was, when that day came, they would put it down. Right? They would just put it down. And their day was very interesting because it was not like a day of formal meditation, but it was a day where, you know, it was just everything was done with ease. I mean, there was no work, right? So you put down your work, you put down your discussions about work. It was a day really to nurture their, you know, it's like just to nurture everything that's human, right? I mean, they would obviously do more meditation than usual, but they also read or study, you know, more emphasis on meals and meal preparation, being together with good friends, taking walks in nature, listening to music, you know what I mean? But it was that kind of day. So it was not a day of formal practice, right? Which is nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. But it wasn't about that. And what it reminded me of was in the Jewish tradition of Sabbath. You know, on the seventh day, God rested, right? And we've kind of lost that. And I think it's a very, I would certainly recommend it if you ever go to Plum Village or any of the Thich Nhat Hanh communities, they call it now lazy days. And it doesn't seem to be as pure as it used to be when there were just a few of them. But because, again, I think it's harder as when it gets more people to maintain that. But a lazy day really implied that. And especially lazy, I think in our society, has a very negative, right? It's very negative. Someone's lazy. I remember Thich Nhat Hanh, when I met him, he always described himself. He said, you know, I'm just a lazy monk. I mean, that's what he... And he wasn't embarrassed by that. You know, he really used it to describe his approach to life. Right? That for him, it's not about getting things done, being productive. It's really just about enjoying life and enjoying everything you do. And I think that's very much part of this kind of day, is taking a day where you just enjoy. You enjoy your relationships. You enjoy your friends and family, right? You just enjoy food and eating, and you enjoy the sky, and you enjoy the earth. It's a day, it's simple day, right? Simplicity. And so in listening to you, I certainly... And maybe there's a way that we can be more, certainly I've talked about it in the past, but maybe we can really sort of kind of institute it more as a key practice within the kind of broader community. Now, again, different people have different work schedules, and some people work, you know, it's hard to go, you know, one day, this is the day. But I think everybody, see, a lot of people maybe are already going, ooh, I couldn't do that in my life. You see, that's the problem. Of course we could do it. Right. I remember years ago when I was a therapist, and I used to see these hard driving, totally stressed out type A types, and they go, oh, I can't do this and I can't miss that. I mean, you know, and I just got to get, you know, no matter what, no matter I'm sick, I said, because everything was so important to them. I said, you know, if you had a heart attack, right, you know, you wouldn't be able to attend that meeting tomorrow. You know, you know, you'd be in the hospital for days, and it would, you know, life would go on without you. Sorry. You know, we perceive ourselves as the essential piece of life, and the most important piece of life, which again is a kind of arrogance, you see, and a grandiosity. I think it's important that we live with a greater humility, with an understanding that, you know, we're just part of this, and we are not the major part of it. We are part of it, and we need to take. I think again, part of that is that I think a couple of them mentioned that whole self-nurturing piece. That we recognize that in this day and age, the capacity to take care of oneself emotionally, physically, is essential, right? You know, so we can be better colleagues, better husbands and wives, better parents, better children. We can be better, you know, members of our community because we are healthy, right? And we know how to be healthy. And we know how to nurture happiness in ourselves and others. And you know, you can read the books, you can listen to the tapes, you can talk the talk, you know, but to become that kind of person in your circle of relationships, in your families, at work, in your community, in the world, right? To be able to bring that into the world, this broken world, this unhappy world, right? Unfortunately, it takes time, you see. It takes time, and it needs a kind of inner cultivation, you see. It needs a capacity where we are present to ourselves, and we know ourselves, and we know how to heal ourselves, and we know how to transform ourselves, to become that cell in the body of our families, the body of our relationships, in the body of the world, that can help the healing process of the whole world. I mean, it sounds grandiose, perhaps, but it's really true. And unfortunately, there's no other way to do it, you see, other than taking the time to do it. And again, we are people who quantify everything. And we kind of value, you know, if we look at where we spend our time, and if we tied that into what I value most in life, would it correlate in your life? Think about it. Would it correlate in your life? Those things that I really feel most passionate about, the values in life that I most cherish, right? Are those getting the major focus in my life? And a lot of the time it means time, right? Or when I look at how I spend my time, where I put my energy, are those areas really congruent and productive of the value and meaning that I really want in my life? Now again, I mean, we all don't have absolute freedom to do whatever we want, and you know what I'm saying, but there is more time in the world than we think we have. Right? Sam said, Sam lives right across the street from me. If I'd said, Sam, you know, why don't you start getting up at 5:30 in the morning? If I'd said that to her a couple of months ago, Sam would have said what? No! But not only would Sam have said no, she would have said no because it was just incomprehensible to her, right? That she could do it or that anybody would want to do it, right? Or there'd be any reason to get up earlier than 8 and, you know, throw yourself together in 10 minutes and get out the house. Right, and all of a sudden, because you stopped, that energy of your life, that habit energy of your life, right, and put yourself in an environment where something totally different was being nurtured and supported, and all of a sudden Sam goes, yeah. And all of a sudden Sam has 2 more very alive hours to her day, right? And if I talked to Sam a month ago, she said, well, you know, I'm just very busy. I got so much going on. It's really hard for me to find a time to meditate or take a mindful walk in nature. I mean, just, you know. Right? And all of a sudden, Sam goes, wow, it's time. See, it's interesting. And I think we all have to be aware that we all have that. Again, we're all different. I mean, you know, different stages of life and responsibilities and activities. But I assure you, the time is there. And to me, especially if you have a life where there's a lot of responsibility these days, it is even more important that you do this kind of exercise, right? Because you have less, you know, people who are retired or semi-retired or independently wealthy, you know, they have lots of time to look at this. But people who have a lot of responsibilities in life, right, really have to look at this and find those spaces. So again, once a week, in terms of the context of your own life, putting it down. You know, no computer, no news, no Facebook, no, just put a little message on your phone. I'm taking a day off today. That's all. The world's not going to come to an end. Right? Is there anybody here who doesn't believe that? If you do, you can raise your hand. Anybody believes the world's going to come to an end, everything's going to stop if you stayed off your computer, your phones, for one day? Good. Right? So there's a stopping of a certain kind of energy, and more importantly, you're using that time to cultivate another kind of energy, which is just, again, even if you're not a practicing meditator or a Buddhist or a spiritual person, I think just for pure mental health, pure emotional health, and the health and well-being of your families and your friends, and, you know, this would be a wonderful thing. And then, of course, you know, weekly sanghas, daily practice, intensives, retreats, you know, all these kinds of things, kind of on a hierarchy, right? You know, that depending on your life condition and situation, you may have more available to or not. But it's interesting, in Tibet, when one wanted to kind of go beyond kind of normal everyday Buddhist practice, you know, study and practice and living that life, and one wanted really to develop oneself in a more meditative way, in a more really understand the nature of mind and really transform the heart and mind. Very traditionally, you would go on what was called a 3-year, 3-month, 3-day retreat. You know, and it was not like everybody was doing it, you know, but it was very normal and understandable that that's what you did. So obviously it was a society where people could do things like that. And then, you know, if it went well, you may do another one. Again, that sounds pretty far out for our society, right? Taking that kind of break in one's life. But in a smaller way, I think we need to find ways, even during the day. You know, again, there's an energy to our day. And the problem is, if we don't stop during the day and break into this train of thought and emotionality and habit energy, it will continue, right? So even if you are a busy person and you have a busy life with work and family, etc., to find time throughout the day, 5 minutes, right? Just to stop, go in the bathroom, close the door, breathe, watch your mind. Where, you know, how is my mind? How am I? You know, because all day long we're doing, we're doers. And we talk with each other about doing. But to stop throughout the day and, you know, how's my mind? How am I, you know? Is my mind peaceful? Is my heart full with positive emotions? Am I relaxed? If I am, good, right? But what if I'm not? Well, time to reset. You know, reset. Every couple hours, even in your busy life, stop, reset. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he developed, you know, practices, you know, I'm sure you're aware of them for for busy people. In the Plum Village tradition, little gathas, little things you say to yourself when you're, you know, when you're at a stoplight, right? Rather than being annoyed because the light, you know, because you missed the green light and it turned red, and just can't, you know, and can't wait to take off again. Oh, you know, the car has stopped. Let me stop. Just feel myself stopping, feel myself sitting here. Maybe look out the window and see the sky, right? Stop. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, little gatha again, little poem, but, you know, pick up 3 breaths before you answer the phone. Phone rings, These days, what do people do? Boop. Little ding, got a phone call, got a message, right? Ding, 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 ding. People are just dinging all the time. And everybody's got to respond right away. Ding, respond. Ding, respond. You know, it's like we're like rats in the lab. We're trained up to respond to the dings. So he says, no, don't do that. There's no freedom in that. Take three breaths before you answer the phone. Come back to yourself. So when you pick up the phone, you're fresh. Even at work, you can do that, not just at home. So you're fresh to talk to the person, whether it's personal or work, you know, that in a way that your mind is clear and you can be very present to that person. So there are lots of little things that we can do during the day, even in our busy life, that kind of slow things down and creates moments of stopping where you can check in with yourself, you can come back to yourself. And if you are living somewhat of a conscious life, you know, that you want to move your life in a certain direction. Let's say you want to be more mindful, or you want to be more open, you want to be more relaxed, or you want to be kinder, you want to be more compassionate, you want to be more patient. You know what I'm saying? Those kind of things that many of us are working on. Well, how often during the day do we check in with ourselves to see how we're doing? You know? Taking those few moments just to, you know, how's it going? Oh, that's right, I was supposed to be mindful today. I forgot about that one. That's right, I was supposed to be more patient with this coworker who drives me up a wall. That's right. You see what I'm saying? I mean, without that stopping and that checking in, it's very hard to lead a life of change. Where you want to change, right? Where you have an intention or an aspiration to be different, live differently, think differently, feel differently. I mean, those are all good things, but how do you implement it, right? How does it become real in your life if we're not doing things throughout the day that allow us to be conscious of what we're doing and to constantly be, you know, checking in? If we're doing it, great. We give ourselves a pat on the back. But if we're not, we have an opportunity to reboot, right? To reset, to begin again. Is that clear? And so it's important to have that those opportunities in our life, and they are there. Even if we're busy, right? We can begin to see that we can build in these moments. And as Sam says, you know, we often begin with, oh, I can't do that. But those opportunities are there, I assure you. Any questions about what's been, talked about today? Think about your life and what we've talked about. Do you have any questions about what it's about, or why do it, or how to do it, or whether you can do it? Yes.
We need to use the microphone because we're on live stream. Thank you.
I really appreciate the idea of resetting and think mm-hmm. it would be very useful for me.
And what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Oh, I think it would be very useful for me to incorporate into my life. Mm-hmm. But what if you are kind of drowning in negative thoughts? Like, how do you...
Whether you're drowning in what kind of thoughts?
Negative thoughts.
Negative thoughts, yeah.
And so you need a reset, but how do you use that reset to like kind of clear out the negativity?
You want that answer in 2 minutes or less?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so that's obviously a whole Dharma talk, and you know, dealing with afflictions and all that is very much part of our practice. So I mean, there's a lot there that we do with that. So you begin with an awareness that for whatever reason, right, your mind tends toward negativity. And it's not like you wake up in the morning going, today I'm really going to work on being the most negative person I can be. Is that true? No, it's not your intention, is it? But your intention is probably the opposite, isn't it? And yet you find, right, that these negative thoughts or impulses arise. So in Buddhist psychology, we understand that we have this, what we call the storehouse consciousness, you know, this deeper consciousness within us, which is the repository of our past. All the impressions from our past thoughts and feelings are there. Okay? That is why, right, without trying, it just arises, right? You don't have to do anything, do you? Okay. So we all begin there. You know, everybody's here is different, but all of us know this mind has a life of its own, right? And throughout the day, it is unfolding in ways that are true to itself and not true to you. Why is that? It's not because you have a bad mind or it's defective. It's just been conditioned that way. What's conditioned it? Causes and conditions from your past. All right? So the first step is, this may be hard, is to accept that. Not to fight it, not to hate it, not to be disgusted by it, not to feel hopeless, okay? But to understand, you know, this is it. Okay? Why? Because of causes and conditions. That's very important. Because when we were talking about the second arrow, it's like, you know, it's like the negative thought is enough, but then we get negative about having negative thoughts. You see, so that's called the second, the third. We just, you know, like one arrow in us isn't that bad enough, but now we shoot more arrows. So it's all those, you know, that's one thing that you have some control over, right? And part of it is just acknowledging, I am aware, this is mindfulness, I am aware that negativity has arisen in me. Like, it's not you, because you don't want it, do you? No, but it's your mind. At this point, it's conditioned toward negativity. And so a simple, just mindful awareness, I'm aware there's negativity in me. It's not a big deal, is it? It's not going to kill you. Hold on, is it? You say, it's not, you know, we got to be, it's just, these are just thoughts. Okay, and they just come and go, right? Okay. So you're aware that there's negative thoughts within you. Now, if you don't keep shooting more arrows, it'll probably dissipate. Okay, now. So, we cannot control the past, and it's arising. And it's often said in the meditative tradition that practice begins with the second thought. Now, that means the first thought is your negative thinking. Okay? That just arises by itself, right? That's your default. You don't have to work on that. Now, the question for Carrie, this is where practice begins, is what are you going to do now? See? Up to now, when that negativity arises, you've had no control over it. It's just, you're right there, right? Okay. You don't have to do anything. It's right there. That's the same way for everybody. That's your conditioned mind. Now, what are you going to do now? Hopefully you're not going to be shooting more negativity into yourself. Okay? So you want not to do that. Okay? But you also want to begin to plant positive seeds in your mind. You cannot undo what you've done in the past, but you can stop feeding it. Okay? But what you can do now is do something different. So what would be a wholesome kind of thought that you could replace as an antidote to the negative one? For example, what could you do?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's
so,
the problem.
All right. Well, give me an example of a negative thought that may just pop up.
Okay. That I'm unlovable.
Okay. That's a terrible one, by the way. Okay. I mean, there are people who love Donald Trump. I mean, there's your proof that everybody is lovable. Okay? I mean, again, why do you have this belief about yourself that you're unlovable? Well, if you know your story, if you know your child, you know, you go, well, I can see it. But were you born with that thought?
I doubt it.
I'm sure you didn't. Because when you were born, you couldn't even speak English. You couldn't even think. It is something that developed. Why? Because you were a child and you misinterpreted things. Right? Children think they're the center of the universe and everything's their fault. So they don't go, you know, my parents, you know, because of their causes and conditions, have a problem, you know, being very positive and loving. You see, children don't think that way, do they? Right? They don't go, gee, maybe these people have a problem. There's no, you know, I don't have a problem. I'm just a little kid. Right? You know, just doing what little kids do. But the reason I'm not shown a lot of love or I'm getting a lot of negativity is because of them. You see, they're screwed up. They don't know how to love. You see, children they don't have developed minds. They don't have a lot of insight. You see what I'm saying? So children go, ooh, there must be something wrong with me. Okay? But then if you don't stop and kind of, as you get older, kind of relook at all that stuff, it'll very continue. Everybody is lovable, right? I mean, complete jerks are loved. Terrible people are loved, right? You know, people loved Adolf Hitler, didn't they? I mean, he had a girlfriend. I mean, you know, people, right? I mean, that should show you, right? So when you have these crazy kind of thoughts, like I'm unlovable, you need to kind of understand they're only arising because of causes and conditions, because of my experience and I was a child. And how could they be true? You know, in any kind of rational way. I mean, has anybody ever liked you?
Yes.
Well, isn't that proof? That maybe you're, what?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I know, because inside you probably go, well, if they really knew me, right? They really knew me. I fooled them this so far. You see? See, you won't let reality win. Right? You know, people who have strong prejudices against other people are like that. They just have a prejudice. And they impose that on other people. Not real people, but it's from their mind. Right? And many of us, unfortunately, have like this prejudice against ourselves. And so even when in reality they're blatantly untrue, illogical, we still hold on to them. I mean, have you ever loved anybody? Were they all just the most wonderful beings in the whole world?
No.
Did they have their issues?
For sure.
For sure. And yet you love them.
Yeah.
Now, what does that tell you? You don't have to be perfect to be loved. And yet, in your own life, you think, oh, because I'm not perfectly this or that, I'm unlovable. So we need to be willing to challenge these beliefs we have. Okay. And again, a lot of Buddhism is about right thinking, learning to think clearly. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with you. There never was anything wrong with you. Is that clear? Yeah. So please stop thinking these things. Anyhow, okay, one more question.
Okay, well, what about people who do have plenty of time and who do not live this kind of hectic life that you've been talking about?
Who don't live what kind of life?
This kind of hectic life.
Uh-huh, who don't live that life.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So I, as you were talking, I was trying to figure out how this all would apply to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really clear.
So you're one of those people who does have time and do not have a hectic life.
Correct.
Yeah, so, and you want to perhaps begin to build some of these things into your life.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't even know what you mean by these things.
Well, begin to be more present and mindful in your life, develop a little bit of a meditative practice, begin to devote more time to your own inner peace and cultivation of a happy mind. And
right.
Yeah, you'd like to do that.
Right.
Good.
I mean, like, I also have a lot of negative thoughts, and I'm not very content.
Yeah, well, it's very hard to be content if you have a lot of negative thoughts. Negativity does not contribute to contentment. Negativity contributes to a conflicted, unhappy mind. Right? You're absolutely right. So the cultivation of right thinking, ways of thinking that produce a peaceful mind and a harmonious mind and an open mind is part of the meditative tradition. You know, what is your name?
Renata.
Renata. So again, first comes the intention or the aspiration to want to begin to change your life, okay? To begin to cultivate a different kind of mind, right? It's got to start from the inside, with you beginning to nurture within you that desire to change. Okay? Secondly, you need to feel that you're capable of doing that. You need to have some belief in that, that you can change. Now, part of the way you have belief is you join a tradition in which people, that's what they're doing, and that's what they've done. It's like alcoholics join AA. Right? Why do they? One of the reasons they join AA, because it's a group of people who've done it, right? Who in their lone lives have demonstrated that one can live free of alcohol. Right? So in the same way, it's good to be around people who have in their own life demonstrated that one can come from a place of great negativity or whatever and unhappiness and can change. That's important to get that kind of relationships. Right? And then it's important to find yourself some mentor or teacher, somebody who can teach you how to do it, right? Because you're right, on your own, you know, I mean, we can learn to play the guitar by ourselves, but it's certainly, you know, it's nice to have a teacher, isn't it? Certainly makes it easier. And to have some regularity about, you know, seeing them once a week, right? Holds us accountable. By ourselves, you know, like Sam said, by ourselves, it's like, just do what I feel. And we don't realize that most of what we're doing as we feel is because it's really just about, you know, it's really not how we feel. It's how we're conditioned to feel by the past. See, we think we are who we are because this is who I am, but we really are who we are because we've been conditioned to be this way. In Buddhism, we say, essentially, everyone's a Buddha. Everyone's a Buddha. Everyone has that capacity to be awake, to be whole, to be complete, to be open-hearted, to be wise. That's who we really are. For many of us, it's hard to believe. But that's the truth. So again, we need these various kinds of supports to help us develop along that path. Okay? Thank you, Renata. And we will stop now. Thank you.
Thank you.